The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It was often the case when people were going to be executed by the IRA that they would take them down into the Republic, often to remote rural stretches. And in this instance, what I learned was that they took her down and turned her over to a local unit whose job it was to kill the convoy. But the local unit found that they couldn't do it. We don't know exactly why, but most likely because she was a woman. They may have known that she was a mother of 10 and a widow, right? So if you kill her, you're orphaning 10 kids. And so the local unit sent for backup, for reinforcements from Belfast to come and finish the job.
I'm Michaela Fogel, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, February 15th, 2020. In 2013, Patrick Radden Keefe, a staff writer for The New Yorker, came across the obituary of a woman named Dolores Price, a former member of the Irish Republican Army, or IRA. His interest in Price led to sprawling research about an appalling crime that took place over the three decades-long troubles in Northern Ireland: the disappearance of Jean McConville, a widowed young mother of 10 children. This research led to his 2019 book, Say Nothing, A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland. I sat down with Keefe to discuss his book, the shocking history of McConville's disappearance, the broader context of the terrorism and counterterrorism campaigns in Northern Ireland over the course of the Troubles, the complex morality and immorality of both, and what happened to the perpetrators and victims of this crime. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 508, Patrick Radden Keefe on Say Nothing, A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland. So we'll zoom out in a second, but I want to start with one specific story from Say Nothing about a young man named Michael McConville who gets into a taxi in Belfast. What happens there?
So one day in Belfast, this guy, Michael McConville, hails a taxi, a black taxi, and gets into the back seat, and the taxi pulls away from the curb, and it's just him and the driver. And as they're driving, he catches a glimpse of the face of the driver in the rearview mirror, and he comes to this alarming realization, which is that he knows who this guy is. This driver, who's a grown man, decades earlier, when Michael was 11 years old, had been part of a team of people who came and took Michael's mother, a woman named Jean McConville, out of the house, and she was never seen again. And he carried around the memory of that guy's face, and all those years later, he just happened to get into a taxi and discover that the driver was this perpetrator, this person who'd taken his mother away.
I remember reading that section of the book and just feeling almost like terrified. I mean, like, obviously, you know, he's going to be okay because he obviously survived to talk to you about it. But I wanted to start there because it just gave you such a sense of almost the claustrophobic nature of this conflict. And so now that listeners sort of had that picture in their heads, I want to zoom way out and talk about, why did you write this book? How did you do it? What was the story you were hoping to tell?
So my day job is I'm a staff writer at the New Yorker magazine, and I tend not to pick an issue to write about. I'm much more oriented toward stories of people, and then I tend to zoom out from there. In this case, I read an obituary in 2013 of a woman named Dolores Price, who had been a member of the IRA and had died in 2013. And the obituary suggested that she had had some connection to the disappearance of that woman, Jean McConville, in 1972. So my aperture when I went into this was actually pretty narrow. I wanted to look at this specific story of the connection between these two women, one of them a victim who was taken away and disappeared, murdered in 1972 and buried in a secret grave, and the other a perpetrator, this woman who was a member of the IRA who had played some role in that operation. And it started out as a magazine article, quite a long article for The New Yorker that came out in 2015. And it felt to me, even when the piece came out, as though there was a deeper story to be told that wasn't really a full spectrum history of the Troubles, but was more a story about a handful of people and the ways in which their lives intersected against the backdrop of the Troubles, really from the outset of the Troubles, which is in the late 1960s, right up through the present day.
So this moment, this disappearance of Jean McConville, and as people found out 40 years later, she was taken across the border and murdered. And that's another aspect of her story and her family's story that you tell. But we're a national security law podcast. So when I read this, I couldn't help but sort of think of the disappearance of Jean McConville as a terrorist incident. It was meant to send a message. And you tell the story of three intersecting groups of people. You have the perpetrators of this attack. You have the victims, her family, her 10 children, and the security apparatus who's working to combat this campaign of terrorism. So we're going to sort of go through each of those groups of people. So Dolores Price and her colleagues, the people who perpetrated this attack, who are they? Why did they do what they did?
So there had been, for hundreds of years, a tension on the island of Ireland over the relationship with England and the British. And in the 1920s, you get the Irish War for Independence. And at that point, you have the Republic of Ireland, which is the country we call Ireland today, which is 26 counties in the south of the island. It's actually most of the island of Ireland, which gain independence. But there are these six counties left over in the north, which remain part of the UK. And you still have British dominion over those six counties. And there were many people like Dolores Price and others in her generation who grew up in the north and were Catholics. So they were a minority, a religious minority in the north. And grew up in a situation in which there was, I don't think anybody would disagree with the assessment that there was tremendous discrimination against Catholics in the North. It was tough to get jobs. It was tough to get good housing. There was very little political power for Catholics to improve their situation. And tensions waxed and waned, and the Irish Republican Army was always present in some form. By the 1960s, it was largely a kind of vestigial organization, not a very serious fighting force. And in the late 60s, tensions start to sharpen. And the push for a more violent form of Irish republicanism, which is essentially seeking to drive the British out of Northern Ireland, experiences a big uptick. And the IRA actually splits at that point. There's the kind of legacy organization, which was perceived by some as too moderate, the official IRA. And then you get the provisional IRA, which is this more violent offshoot. And there's a younger generation, and it's people like Dolores Price, who join up in the early 1970s and start really bringing the fight in a more aggressive manner to the state, to, you know, businesses, to the police, and then eventually to the British Army, which comes in, you know, ostensibly to keep the peace, but quickly is ensnared as a combatant itself.
Let's talk about those people who came in to combat the Provisional IRA. You talk a little bit about Frank Kitson. Our listeners who study counterterrorism will be familiar with his name because of his involvement with the Mau Mau insurgency and the Malay emergency. how did he take what he had done there and applied it to essentially British domestic territory?
Yeah, Kitson was a really fascinating figure for me because counterinsurgency itself has kind of gone in and out of vogue in recent decades. But I certainly associated Kitson, to the degree that I knew anything about him, with the literature of counterinsurgency, in which continues to be kind of a reigning intellectual because of some of his early work. In Northern Ireland, he was a very divisive figure. He was a guy who, you know, was a British Army officer who came of age fighting these kind of messy wars of colonial disentanglement and made his reputation fighting the Mau Mau, which is in and of itself kind of interesting because if you look at that conflict and how it played out, it was a tremendously brutal campaign that he was involved in. And he then ends up going off to Oxford and spending a year at Oxford, in which he writes a book about counterinsurgency and sort of thinks deeply about how you fight small wars, and then gets dispatched to Northern Ireland, really at the outset of the Troubles. And he's not there all that long, but his kind of intellectual imprimatur is felt very broadly in the early years of the conflict. And, you know, Kitson had these theories that he had developed in places like Malaya and Kenya, and he tried to apply them in Northern Ireland. And so, you know, intelligence was obviously very important to him. One of these issues was just how do you penetrate these insurgent groups and figure out who's who. And then connected to that was his notion of the counter gang, was the idea that one of the most efficient ways to combat an insurgency is to infiltrate it, essentially, to find people who are members of that insurgency who you can turn, and they can become a counter gang on your sort of working on your behalf, but from inside. And so he gets to Northern Ireland and starts applying some of these techniques that he had employed elsewhere in these colonial situations. And you know, I think people could probably argue about the efficacy and the morality and the legality of the techniques that he employs. But I will say that if you look at the full scope of the Troubles, if you back up and look at this three-decade undeclared war that played out in fits and starts in Northern Ireland, so much of the approach ends up being an intelligence approach and one in which you are systematically infiltrating the terrorist group. And I think a lot of that, you know, to a point where by some estimates, by the end of the Troubles, one in four or even one in three members of the IRA was also working for the British state in some capacity. So the level of penetration was astonishing. But I think that that whole approach was born with Frank Kitson in the early 1970s.
That's just an insane number to me. One of these stories you just of an informer you just uncover is fascinating, and I think captures some of the morally problematic issues you've referred to. Can you talk about Steak Knife?
Yeah, absolutely. So you have this situation which is it's born with Frank Kitson, but it intensifies over the decades in which the British Army, British intelligence, but then also the special branch of the Royal Ulster Constabulary, the COPS, are all very busy cultivating sources and informants and getting people to turn. And they do this in a wide variety of ways. And it demoralizes the IRA. And what they do is they eventually institute a kind of internal security unit, which is in the business of figuring out who are the moles. And in the vernacular in Northern Ireland, you would call these people sometimes super grasses or grasses, but tout is generally the word that you'll hear, is that you get somebody who's a tout and they're touting, they're informing the authorities. And so they start trying to hunt people down, and you can see how there's a kind of insanity that happens in which they have this internal security unit. There's this guy, Freddie Scappaticci, who is kind of the internal mole hunter, and he and his crew, they were known as the nutting squad, because if they caught you, they would nut you. They would, you know, you'd get a bullet in the head. They're interrogating people. They're torturing people. And it's absolutely the case that they did discover some informants and executed them. It's also the case that there were innocent people who they mistakenly concluded were informants and killed. And so as all this mania is playing out, you start to hear rumors that there's a kind of, you know, it's like the informant of all informants, that there's some very high level informant inside the IRA, and that this person has a code name, which is Steak Knife. And the idea is Steak Knife is somebody at a high level who's been operating for a long time, giving really precious intelligence to the British Army. And, you know, it's sometimes suggested that even that could be a kind of a psyop by the British, right? That if you put that suggestion out there, you demoralize the IRA and get everybody pointing fingers at each other. And so there's this kind of madness that takes hold, and that guy Scappaticci is hunting down and executing more and more people. And eventually, this is in about 2003, it's finally revealed that actually Steak Knife did exist, was a real person, a real source who'd been working with the authorities for a couple of decades at that point, and that the identity of Steak Knife was not who anybody would have thought that it was. In fact, Steak Knife was Freddie Scappaticci, was the very guy who they had entrusted with finding the mole. So it's a little bit of a, I mean, it's almost reminiscent of the Cambridge spies in terms of how this plays out, but it's kind of an embarrassing and damaging revelation all around when it comes out, not least because, you know, it's for the IRA, it's embarrassing because it turns out that they never found the guy, because the guy was the person who they'd sent to find the guy. But for the British, it also raises a whole series of questions, right? Which is, you have this murderous individual, Freddie Scappaticci, who's been killing people left and right. And in fact, he's been doing so with the tacit authorization of the state, because he's been an agent of the state for decades. So it raises really interesting moral, but also legal questions about the complicity of the British state.
So has there been any legal fallout from the revelations around Steak Knife?
There has been. I mean, it would be premature to draw any conclusions about how it will end, but there have been a series of lawsuits initiated. Steak Knife has been linked to as many as 50 murders. And I should say, Freddie Scappaticci to this day denies that he's Steak Knife, but he's the only one denying it at this point. I don't think there's any uncertainty about that. So you have now a big government investigation in the UK, where the government is, you know, they've assigned a fairly high profile police inspector to lead this multi-year investigation with a big team of investigators to try and get to the bottom of the whole Scappaticci Steak Knife episode. But I think, you know, cynical people, and I would probably count as one of them, wonder just how far the British government is going to end up going in terms of bringing justice to the people who were killed by Scappaticci, because, you know, Scappaticci, as we speak, is basically in witness protection, and it's the government that's hiding him. You know, he was their guy. And so I think there's sort of no scenario in which a thoroughgoing investigation by the British state won't ultimately implicate the government at a very, very high level in having aided and abetted the murder of its own citizens.
So as this campaign of violence is happening, as this counterintelligence campaign is raging, what's happening to Dolores Price?
So Dolores was very heavily involved in the IRA, you know, kind of right out there at the edge of the envelope in terms of some of the dirtier stuff that the Provisional IRA was doing in the early 1970s. She was involved in forced disappearances, in bombing missions, and she ends up going in 1973 to London and bringing the fight to the British mainland. She had this feeling, which was essentially, you know, we keep setting bombs in Northern Ireland in order to try and make our point to the English. Why don't we take the war to them? You know, they don't notice when we set a bomb off in a shopping center in Belfast. But what if we were to go to London and do that? So she ends up leading a bombing mission to London, bombing the Old Bailey in the spring of 1973 and getting caught and then being sent to Brixton Prison with a life sentence, which in practice translated to 20 years, and going on hunger strike. And so she has this whole kind of arduous story, which she's going on hunger strike, and then it looks like she's going to die. And so the government starts force feeding her, and there's a great public outcry against the force feeding. And she ultimately is released from prison some years later and ends up actually leaving the IRA and kind of essentially going back to private life.
And is she working alone this whole time, or does she have collaborators that she's working with consistently?
She had very close collaborators. So she, I mean, first and foremost, her own sister, her younger sister, Marion Price, who joined the IRA with her. And the two of them actually had come from an Irish Republican family and had, you know, both of their parents had been in the IRA, as well as other relatives. And so it was a bit of a family tradition. And she worked with a team that they called the Unknowns, which was a sort of a small clandestine unit that did particularly sensitive paramilitary work and answered to Gerry Adams, who at the time was an IRA commander in Belfast.
So this leads me to the question, how do we know all of this? You keep talking about how everything was so secret, the name of the group was the Unknowns. How'd you end up writing a whole book about it?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, there's a few answers. There is a huge literature on the Troubles. And so, you know, this was part of what was daunting for me coming into this subject is that there are hundreds of books written on the Troubles. And, you know, that was daunting in the sense of, you know, what could I possibly add? But actually helpful in another sense, in that the foundation of this story had been written about in numerous places. Even so, it was a challenge for me because there is a culture of silence. You know, the title "Say Nothing" is taken from a Seamus Heaney poem, "Whatever you say, say nothing." And it was very much the ethos of the IRA that you didn't talk about your membership in the IRA. You didn't talk about any of the things you did in the IRA. And part of what drew me to the story in the first place was that when I read that obituary of Dolores Price back in 2013, it talked about how there'd been a secret oral history project at Boston College in which former paramilitaries from both sides in the conflict had basically come in and told their stories on tape with the understanding that those oral histories wouldn't be revealed until after they died. And Dolores Price was one of the people who took part in that. So I ended up getting hold of a number of unpublished interviews that Dolores had done and one very long interview that one of her associates in the IRA, a guy named Brendan Hughes, had done as part of the Boston College project. And then I just kept going back and forth to Northern Ireland and interviewing people. And that was a slow process. But I went 7 times over 4 years and slowly made connections and gained some trust and got to a point where I felt like I could tell the story. And for me, what that meant was not just that I could get the names and dates and who did what and the type of thing you might read in a work of history or political science. But for me, the challenge was, can you tell this story in enough vivid detail that it actually feels like quite an intimate story? Because I think if you do it that way, it's a little harder to stand in easy judgment of the people you're reading about. You're kind of forced to relate to them on some level and try and think about why it was that they did the things they did. It's harder to dismiss them just as violent types or psychopaths. Which is not to let them off the hook, but I wanted you to feel like you knew them. And I felt as though if I could get that right, it would implicate you in some way. And you'd have to maybe think a little bit more deeply about, you know, some of the kind of fraught moral dimensions of this story.
One of the most morally fraught or interesting people you discuss in the book, actually, you didn't get to interview, you didn't get to speak to, but you sort of draw a picture of him through what you're able to find out from other people, and that person is Jerry Adams. Can you talk a little bit, not just about him, but about the people you highlighted, Brandon Hughes and Dolores Price, about their relationship with him and how that gave you essentially the story that you told about Jerry Adams?
Yeah, gladly. I mean, part of what was appealing to me about this story was not just these characters, these people, but the relations between them and the way those relationships evolved. And so you have Dolores Price and then this guy, Brandon Hughes, who was a famous IRA tactician, a guy who was a very operational commander who just did hundreds of operations for the IRA over the years. And then the guy who was their commanding officer, Jerry Adams, who was always more of a kind of political thinker. He was more of a strategist. He wasn't the guy on the ground with the gun. He was the one behind the lines giving orders. But in the early 1970s, there was no daylight between these people. They were comrades. They were very certain, both of the ends that they were hoping to achieve, the end that they were hoping to achieve, and also of the means that they would employ to do it. And that changed over time. And the change was what I found really interesting. So people who know the name Jerry Adams today probably know him because he was involved in actually ending the Troubles. So he is celebrated, and I think rightly celebrated, for having steered the IRA to the negotiating table and helped hammer out the Good Friday Agreement in 1998, which ends the conflict. And certainly in the United States, I think for a whole bunch of reasons, not the least of which is that the U.S. government and the Clinton administration and George Mitchell were instrumental in helping bring that accord about, there's been a tendency just to regard the Good Friday Agreement as a, you know, as a kind of an uncomplicated victory, just an absolute triumph, the idea that you can end a war that's been going on for three decades. But what I was really fascinated to learn was that for frontline soldiers like Dolores Price and Brendan Hughes, their feelings about the peace when it came were much more complicated and vexed. And the reason was that the ambition of the IRA had always been to get the British out. But the nature of the peace is that it was a compromise. The British didn't leave. So you end up with this peace agreement, which essentially says, if there's a day when, you know, when you put it to a referendum and a majority of the people want Northern Ireland to leave the UK and reunify with the Republic of Ireland, then that'll happen. But in the meantime, we will accept the continued relationship in which Northern Ireland is part of the UK. And for Dolores Price and Brendan Hughes, what happened was when that came about, they said, wait a second, we did these terrible things in the early 70s. And we did them because we had this sense that we would eventually get the Brits out. And when that happened, the end that we had achieved would justify all the terrible things we did to achieve it. And when Jerry Adams goes to the negotiating table and says, I will accept the idea that Northern Ireland is going to continue being part of the UK, they felt that that was a betrayal, that he'd sold out the armed struggle, and that he'd left them in a situation in which they're kind of reeling from trauma, trying to make sense of the pretty abominable things they had done, and that they'd been robbed retroactively of any moral justification for having done it. And to add insult to injury, Jerry Adams famously, to this day, denies that he was ever in the IRA. He says he was only ever a political figure. Nobody actually believes this. It's kind of a common joke in Northern Ireland. But Adams does continue to insist, in the face of a mountain of contrary evidence, that he was never in the IRA. But you can imagine, if you're Brendan Hughes or you're Dolores Price, this was your commanding officer, who has, you know, in their minds, kind of sold out the armed struggle in this peace agreement, but then also
so seems to kind of disown them, to say, well, I, you know, personally, I don't have any trauma. I don't have any blood on my hands because I was never in the IRA. That's on you. You know, you undertook those decisions. When they would respond, you know, you gave us the orders to do these things. So that to me felt like a kind of rich and interesting dynamic. And the aperture of the book is again, it's pretty tightly on these people and on the troubles. But as you and your listeners, I'm sure, can imagine, I, you know, during the time I've spent working on the book, what I was thinking about is people my age who've come back from Iraq and Afghanistan who say, you know, I went to war. In some instances, I did some things and I saw some things that that keep me up at night, that give me nightmares, that I have trouble grappling with. And I don't have a victory to show for it. Like the rationale that we went in for didn't end up bearing out, and it seemed that the game changed, and that makes it harder to deal with some of the things that I personally did and saw.
And there's a group of people that we haven't talked about, which is the McConvilles. So as you said, Jean McConville, when she was taken, left behind 10 children, and she never came back. What happened to them, and did they ever find out what happened to their mother?
So the McConville children from a very early age had this life of compounding tragedy. It's 10 kids. Their father died early in 1972. So Jean McConville was a widow. And when she gets taken away, they didn't know if she was coming back or not. And, you know, this was what you would call a forced disappearance. And I think part of the reason that, you know, that's legally speaking, it's considered a crime against humanity, is that when you take somebody away and disappear them, you deny their family any certainty about what happened. And so there were some of Jean's children who grew up thinking she might come back, hoping she might come back. But the truth was they'd all been orphaned, and they were spread out to different orphanages. The family was split up. It was incredibly difficult for them. And there was this question, why did this happen to our mother? And the answer actually goes back to Frank Kitson and the way in which the counterinsurgency strategy worked in the Troubles. There had been a rumor that Jean McConville was an informant for the British Army. And I've never gotten to the bottom of whether or not that's true. Jean McConville's children to this day very vehemently deny it. The IRA did end up ultimately claiming that she was an informant and that was why she was killed. I don't know the truth one way or the other. But they didn't know what exactly had happened to her until the peace process in the 1990s. And at that point, the IRA acknowledged that they'd taken Jean McConville away and killed her, but wouldn't really give many more details. They tried to find her body and couldn't, which is actually not totally atypical in these situations of disappearances when you try and find them decades later, the landscape has changed, people's memories are imperfect, and it's hard to recover the remains. And eventually a guy was a beachcomber was walking on the beach in the Republic of Ireland in 2003 and stumbled upon a set of bones. And it was Jean McConville. They ended up doing DNA testing and determining that those were her bones. Gradually, in the years since then, little details have shaken loose about the circumstances in which Jean was killed. And part of what I was doing in the book was trying to assemble the things we knew and find out a little bit more. And I was ultimately able to tell a slightly more complete story about the circumstances of her murder. And, you know, the McConville kids are still looking for justice. I mean, when I made the discoveries that I did at the end of the book, I went and I had to tell them prior to the book coming out that I didn't want them to read about it in the press. But they would tell you that they haven't seen justice yet, and they've been fighting for it for almost half a century.
Now zoom in on those details that you found and the, as legally we would say, the allegation that you make at the end of the book and the McConville search for justice in the wake of that allegation.
So I had slowly been accumulating details about the circumstances of Jean McConville's death. And I knew that she'd been taken down across the border by Dolores Price. It was often the case when people were going to be executed
by the IRA, that they would take them down into the Republic, often to remote rural stretches. And in this instance, what I learned was that they took her down and turned her over to a local unit whose job it was to kill McConville. But the local unit found that they couldn't do it. We don't know exactly why, but most likely because she was a woman. They may have known that she was a mother of 10 and a widow, right? So if you kill her, you're orphaning 10 kids. And so the local unit sent for backup, for reinforcements from Belfast to come and finish the job. And there were three people who came from Belfast, and one of them was Dolores Price. And then the second person was a guy named Pat McClure, who was the head of the Unknowns, that secret unit. And I went through a whole process of trying to find Pat McClure. He's dead now. I had heard that he had left Northern Ireland and gone to Canada in the 1980s. And I tried to find him and his family in Canada. And it turned out that actually he didn't go to Canada. He went to Connecticut and died of cancer in Connecticut in the 1980s. But Pat McClure was the second one there. And then there was a third person. And I had heard a kind of a tantalizing clue about who that third person was. And one thing that I had heard quite definitively was that the third person was the person who pulled the trigger, who killed Jean McConville. And it was not actually a huge objective of mine to figure out who that was, in part because I just assumed that it was some random person, some extraneous, just gunman number three. And because I was telling the kind of story I was telling, which is very much focused on characters and people, you know, the fact that the gunman turns out to be John Smith, you know, some random dude, would not have shed much light on my narrative. But quite by accident, very late in the game, I ended up figuring out who it was, and much to my surprise, it turned out that the shooter was somebody who was already a character in the book. So after wrestling with this kind of, you know, this sort of Agatha Christie type revelation, I then had to think about, okay, well, what do you do with this? And, you know, I talked to a bunch of lawyers, in the US and in Ireland and in the UK. And I ended up approaching that person and saying, here's what I found, through their lawyer, and the lawyer never got back to me. And I went back to Ireland and I wanted to just find corroboration. And I did. I did some additional reporting that brought me to a place where I was 100% sure, just no uncertainty whatsoever, that this person was the killer. And at that point, I decided I would publish the name. And I should say, that's not a decision I take lightly, you know, legally or ethically. You can imagine if I had the tiniest doubt at all, you know, a scintilla of doubt, it would be a pretty terrible thing to accuse someone who's still alive and has never been accused of it, of this notorious war crime. But I was sure. So I published the name. And when the book came out, the McConville children demanded that this person be arrested. The person finally, after five months of kind of no commenting me, the person finally did come out and deny it. But to this day, there hasn't been an arrest. And I think the reason for that is probably pretty straightforward. The evidentiary threshold for me as a journalist, I would say, is actually pretty high. Like I wouldn't have published the name if I didn't feel very, very confident in the evidence that I had. But my threshold is much lower than the threshold in a criminal case. And this is a cold case murder with no physical evidence and no living witnesses, apart from the person who I accused. So you can see how for the authorities, the fact that I named the person in the book is not necessarily sufficient grounds for an arrest.
You talk about this a little bit in the book, but can you talk about the process of shaking those details loose and the moment where you became 100% certain that you could publish that name?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I, you know, the way the whole thing had started was basically that somebody had given me a clue about this person's identity.
I came to think of it, it's kind of a hackneyed analogy. It's like somebody gave me a key, but I didn't know the lock that it fit. So the key by itself, you know, was kind of useless to me. It was like I knew a little bit about the identity of this person. And then what happened was that in another source, in an unpublished interview, actually by Dolores Price, she starts describing a set of attributes, which were exactly the set of attributes that I had been told fit the shooter. So she doesn't say, oh, and the shooter was this person. It's in a completely different context. So that to me seemed really compelling, but not enough. And the first thing I did was I went back to Ireland and talked to the person who had given me the key in the first place and said, listen, here's what I think I know. And the guy, his name is Anthony McIntyre. He was a longtime IRA member who had known all of these people. And he basically said, look, I'm never going to confirm for you that you're right. I'm never going to tell you the name of this person. And I said, okay, well, I'm going to publish this name. And if I shouldn't, I need you to tell me why not. And we spent a whole evening together and he never told me I was wrong. But even that wasn't enough. I still wanted to find more. I wanted somebody to really confirm it. And what I found, it's sort of the all the president's men thing, where the way you approach the reporting changes when you have a theory of the case, right? Like it's one thing to go out in a kind of open-ended situation, asking questions and trying to find out what happened. It's another thing altogether if you think you know what happened and you're going to people and saying, here's what I know, confirm or deny, true or false. And with that kind of approach, I found somebody who knew Dolores Price when she was alive, who she had confided in before she died. And I said, I know who the identity was. You know, had you ever heard that? And this person said, yes, Dolores told me this before she died. And at that point, I felt as though I had enough. Probably I had enough even to a point where had this person, when I reached out to their lawyer, come back and vehemently denied it, I probably still would have published the name and included the denial. But the fact that they didn't deny it for months and months after I spelled all this out to the lawyer, you know, only brought me more kind of comfort and certainty in that decision. And I should say it's, you know, it was over a year ago that the name initially came out when the book was published last November in the UK and Ireland. And looking back at this distance, I have no regrets.
So you have this 30-year period, over 3,000 people die. There are all of these secrets that since the Good Friday Agreement in 1998, they're starting to be told. The picture of what actually happened in Northern Ireland during this time is starting to be filled in. And there's compelling evidence that you provide a pretty big detail yourself. What happens next? What happens next for this region and these people?
Well, there was this kind of uncanny development as I was working on this. I started in 2014 on this project. And when I got going on the book, I sort of had my elevator pitch for what I was doing, my cocktail party explanation. And I was always at pains to say, well, it's about this murder in 1972, but really it's not just about history. It's very much present. It's alive. There are these issues pulsing through this story that have real relevance today. And that was always kind of the case I was making, and I believed it. But what was bizarre is then at a certain point, Brexit happens. And suddenly the idea that the Irish border and the history of the conflict over the Irish border might have relevance today becomes much more widely understood. And it was in that context that the book came out. And I think even today, we're still dealing with a lot of the uncertainty over Brexit. You know, I think just broadly speaking, part of what the Troubles were about is that border. And the two things that happen in the 1990s, where you've got the Good Friday Agreement, but the Good Friday Agreement happens. Part of what allows it to happen is that both the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland are part of the EU. So the border, which had been this sandbagged, heavily militarized outpost, this real symbol of tension and conflict in the region, kind of evaporates. It just sort of goes away. And the insane thing about Brexit is that I think inescapably it is going to reinscribe that border in some fashion. So in terms of where we are and where we're going, I think to a degree that a lot of Americans would be surprised by, and certainly I was surprised by, there is an enduring peace in Northern Ireland, but it's a very brittle peace. There's a lot of tension still. These issues of how to deal with the past remain very unresolved and kind of radioactive. And with Brexit, there's the prospect of a return of some violence. I think probably not anything resembling the Troubles in terms of scope or intensity. But on the margins, I think we'll see more violence. And then in the long run, there's this really kind of intriguing question, which is, since 1998, there's been this kind of creative ambiguity in which Northern Ireland was part of Europe, but also part of the UK. And what Brexit is doing is saying, you got to choose. You kind of have both. And that does make me wonder, is there not some scenario in which you couldn't see a push for the reunification of Ireland at some point in the coming decades? You know, this idea that the very thing that Dolores Price and Brendan Hughes and Gerry Adams wanted, that all of this bloodshed and toil went into over three decades and didn't achieve. The idea that in the long run, maybe that it does come about, but it comes about because of Brexit.
We're going to leave it there. Patrick Radden-Keefe, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. A huge thank you this week to Patrick Radden-Keefe for coming on the show. I can't recommend his book Say Nothing highly enough. And the paperback version is available this month, so check it out at a bookstore near you. And after you're done doing that, you should give the Lawfare podcast a 5-star rating and review on the podcast app of your choice. And check out our online store, www.thelawfarestore.com. The podcast is edited and produced by Jen Patia Howell. Jacob Schultz was your audio engineer this week, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
A little something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.